Apologetics was presented by Ron Julian on August 28, 2005, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
The fact is that I've been busy all summer, as I just said, working on my schooling stuff. And what I've been working on all this week is a paper on apologetics that I have to turn in. So I decided what I'm going to do is talk to you about what I'm talking about in this paper on apologetics. Okay, so now, I'm not going to read the paper to you. That would be excruciating. It's very, this is for a class. It's very dry and academic and boring and all of that good stuff that you're supposed to do when you're in school. So what I'm trying to do is kind of work off of it here. I've got my paper, and I'm sort of trying to talk from it so I can say something that might sound like it makes sense. Let me start out by talking about, just remind us what the topic is when we're talking about apologetics. The word that comes to mind, of course, for us is the English word apology. And everyone always sort of has that initial response, well, what are we apologizing for? It comes from the word apologia in Greek. And the idea is it is a defense. If your defense attorney gets up and makes the case for you, he is giving an apologia. So apologetics is the study of how to make the case for Christianity. How do we defend Christianity as the truth, as a viable way of looking at the world? Now, right away, I don't want you to get your hopes up. You might be thinking, oh boy, he's going to give us some real solid, rock solid, we're going to go out there and we can use these arguments and beat everybody. No, that's not what I'm going to do. The class that I'm taking is about the philosophical issues involved in apologetics. What is it and what is it not and how should we approach it? And that's what I had to write about, and so that's what I'm going to talk about. One of the texts for the class is a book called Five Views of Apologetics, which gives you the idea of out there in the Christian community, there are at least five different perspectives on how apologetics ought to be approached. And one of the things I've discovered is that it is very difficult to pin down what is it that's being disagreed about. What is the debate over? There are these five views. What struck me in the book is that all five of the perspectives agree that it's necessary for the Holy Spirit to do the work of regeneration in a person. A person is not going to come to faith apart from the work of the Holy Spirit. And it also struck me that all five of them seem to agree that there are all sorts of things that one might say when defending Christianity that might, in fact, in a particular case, work. It might actually be effective with one person, and another argument might be effective with another person. So you start out from the beginning saying, well, if everybody agrees that no apologetic method can produce faith in someone, and they all agree that every approach might be productive in someone who's being regenerated by the Holy Spirit, what is there that's left to argue about? I mean, are we arguing about all five approaches admit that apologetics is going to fail without the work of the Holy Spirit, but one approach fails less than the others do? I mean, what exactly is it that the argument is about? Well, it seems to me that the argument out there is about something like this. It is true that you and I can't play God. I can't reach into the internal workings of someone else's heart and do anything about whether they're willing to believe or not or anything like that. But what the apologist would like to do, the question is it possible for me to put any sort of external pressure on the person? That is there a rational, reasonable argument that I could make that a person will confront and be forced to say, yeah, that makes sense. I don't have an answer for that. Are there arguments that are so compelling, so airtight, that the unbeliever is compelled to admit that Christianity must be true or do a major irrational leap in their head to avoid it? So, in other words, it seems to me that the debate over apologetics is one form of the debate that has been going on in the church forever, which is the debate about the relationship between faith and reason. Is faith this thing that is entirely apart from reason, or does it come through the process of thinking and working things out? What is the relationship between those things? And it seems to me, this may be overly simplistic, but as I look at the argument about apologetics out there in the community, these five views at least in the book that we read, it seems like there are kind of two camps. On the one hand, there is the camp that says, well, look, there's this common ground of rationality that we have, believers and non-believers, and yes, through reason, we can put that kind of pressure on the unbeliever. We can put them in the place where the evidence will compel them, if they're ready to be reasonable, they will compel them to see the truth of Christianity. And then there are those that would argue basically, no, that's not how it works. So three of the five versions have that sort of, yes, reason can do that, but they take different approaches. One of the approaches that is sometimes referred to as classical apologetics or two-step apologetics, and the idea here is, first of all, the first thing we have to do is we come along with the classical proofs for the existence of God, the ontological proof or causality or movement or various arguments that are out there that supposedly prove the existence of God. And then, when we've proved that God exists, then we bring in the evidence from the Bible for Jesus as the Messiah and so on. I have to, first of all, bring a person to the place where they admit that there's a God, and then I can say, and what do we know about that God? And the Bible tells me about Jesus and specifically what's going on. In contradistinction to that, there is what is referred to as the evidentialist approach, which basically says, I don't have to do that, those classical proofs for God and that kind of stuff. All I have to do is show you, look, isn't the evidence for the resurrection compelling? Let's show you, look at the testimony. The women went and they said this, and you make your case for how reasonable it is that the resurrection happened. And that pushes the person both to admit that the resurrection happened, and if the resurrection happened, then the only way to explain that is that there's a God who made it happen, so God comes along with the package. So they refer to that sometimes as one-step apologetics. You just make the case for the resurrection and the rest of it comes along. And then the third perspective that is talked about in the book, they refer to as cumulative case. And the idea is no one particular argument is compelling for the resurrection, but we have a series of arguments in all sorts of areas that add up. They make this cumulative case that is compelling for Christianity. And I don't think I exactly understand the analogy that this person uses, but he talks about 10 buckets, each of them that have a leak in it and won't hold the water. I think the idea is if you take the buckets and you nest them inside each other, that the one bucket will cover up the spot where the other bucket has a hole, and so that you put the 10 of them together and supposedly then it holds water. This seems real problematic to me, but maybe I'm not understanding the analogy. Okay, over against those perspectives on apologetics, on the other side of it, from my perspective, what they're basically saying is no, apologetics is not about putting that kind of rational pressure on someone where they have to admit that Christianity is true. One of the versions that's talked about, so there's two in this book that are discussed. One of them is basically there is a philosopher. Jack wrote his PhD dissertation on this philosopher. He is a Christian. He is very well respected in the world of philosophy. He and his team of people who would share his perspectives. It's one of those interesting places where, you know, there are not a lot of places in the academic world where Christians are respected and seem to be top drawer, but Alvin Plantinga is one of those philosophers in the world of philosophy that's highly respected as a philosopher, and everybody knows he's a Christian because his field of philosophy is the question about the relationship between reason and faith. And his philosophical work is all about that. And he argued that belief in God does not need a rational defense because it is what he calls a basic belief. It is the sort of thing, like, when I look and I see the chair there, I don't go through a syllogism, you know, of a way of proving that the chair exists. I just experience that the chair is there. I just know that it's there, and I don't defend it to myself, and I don't have to defend it to myself. And his argument is that belief in God is that way. I look at the world, and I'm designed so that I look at the world, and I know that there's God. That's just the way it is his argument is. So I don't have to make a rational defense, just like I don't have to make a rational defense that chair is there. It's just there. I know it's there, and God is just there, and we know it's there, that he's there, although we can deny it if we want to. That's Plantinga's approach. And then, finally, the other approach that sort of downplays the role of evidence and rational compulsion and that sort of thing is referred to as presuppositionalism. Now, you don't need to remember all these words, but I am going to hammer on this word presuppositionalism with you for a minute because it has been a big deal to me to try to wrestle with this. Probably most of you around here know that although we are not Presbyterian in a lot of ways, we're not in the Reformed camp in some ways because of our view of the church and sacraments and that sort of stuff, places where we would disagree with what Presbyterianism is doing, that we do share this perspective with them, a very high view of the sovereignty of God and the grace of God. We would agree with the perspective on salvation that you find in writers like Calvin and the reformers who came after him. And in that world, see, this is the world that I'm learning about because I'm taking classes from Reformed Theological Seminary, and they're talking to me as if I were Presbyterian, although I'm not. So I'm learning a lot about how they look at this stuff. And in that world, this presuppositional approach is very big. One of the teachers was talking about how they had room for a variety of perspectives on the approach to apologetics. Like R.C. Sproul is a classical apologist in the way I talked about before, the classical proofs for God followed by the evidence for the resurrection, that sort of thing. And he says, see, we have room for those guys. That's one. And then there's this other approach. We have a teacher who thinks that. Okay, there's one in that camp. And then there's presuppositionalists, which is everybody else on the staff. Every other teacher at RTS is a presuppositionalist. So that's where a lot of people in that world are coming from. The idea here is, look, the unbeliever and the believer are starting on two fundamentally different presuppositions. There is the presupposition that there is no God, or there is the presupposition that there is a God. Where you end up in your thinking depends on what your presuppositions are. So there's no point in trying to rationally argue the unbeliever into becoming a believer because their presuppositions will never allow them to get there. Basically, what you do is, according to this view, is you just, I mean, well, this is tricky. What you do actually gets very complicated in this view, but some people would argue, at least, what you do is you just proclaim the Bible. And if a person is willing to presuppose that the Bible is true, I don't defend the Bible as being true. I just say, this is the Word of God. And if they are willing to presuppose it, then they will arrive at belief. And if they are not, then they won't. But I can't do anything about it because how can I argue them into it? That's the foundational presupposition they're supposed to start with. Now, that's a very tricky model to work with. And I have over the years wrestled with this because I like a lot of what the presuppositionalists say. But I share the problem that a lot of people have with it, is that it sounds crazy. I mean, how do you show that Christianity is true? You assume that Christianity is true. I mean, is what it comes down to. So, is that it? I mean, we don't have any rational reason for believing this. We just sort of go there. Well, we believe it because it's true, they say. I mean, that's the reason we do it, is because it's true. We're supposed to believe it. The Bible says we're supposed to believe it. So, we should. So, believe it. That, a lot of people come up against that and say, you know, that doesn't sound right somehow. So, my class has been taught by someone who comes from that perspective. He's very well known. He's written a number of books on this topic. His name is John Frame. I don't know if any of you have ever encountered him before. I like John Frame a lot. He came and spoke to us many years ago at the study center, just the staff. We kind of talked to him about some things at the time. And he's a good guy. He's one of the classes I've taken that has a lot of content in it and is very interesting. I've really enjoyed the class a lot. So I sort of took it upon myself to try to think about, so what's the deal? Do I agree with them or not on this stuff? And he gave an assignment. The assignment is you have to write a paper giving your own perspective on apologetics. I said, well, okay. So I've been wrestling for the last couple of weeks trying to come up with an articulation of why it is I don't buy the picture that he's been painting in this class. This is, if you've ever tried to do that specifically, you have a class and you know that you're basically setting out to disagree specifically with the teacher and tell him why he's wrong. It gets you thinking, definitely. And in my case, I think it's possible, I'm pretty sure that Frame is the one who's going to read the paper, and I think it's possible that he may know who I am, which none of the other teachers there do, but he has actually been on our mailing list for a number of years at Study Center. So it's possible that he may look at that and say, Ron Julian, I don't recognize that name before. So I may, you know, I'm coming out of the closet here, and I'm doing it publicly. So it's a little nerve-wracking. I'm trying to get it right, you know. So I just wanted to share with you a couple things I've been thinking about this as I've been trying to sort this out. And again, I apologize if this is not an interesting topic to you. Jack will be back next week, and he'll be talking about the Bible and all kinds of good stuff. But like I say, here's what I've been thinking about this. It seems to me that we have to back up here, and I know that philosophy is not always an engaging topic, but we just have to back up and think about how it is that we as human beings decide what's true and how we end up changing our minds, because that's what we're talking about. When we're talking about the knowledge of God, and we're talking about conversion, you know, how you end up moving from one place to another. And before we can evaluate the biblical evidence, it seems to me that we have to have some sort of model in our minds as to how it is we know stuff and change our minds. And in the end, what it's come down to is the reason that I don't actually agree with any of these five perspectives that are in the book is that I'm starting with a different picture of how it is we know things, how we decide whether something's true, and how we change our mind about things. So this is me. I offer it as a thing to think about. This is not the truth from on high. This is just how I think about it right now. Okay. I like to start with, I've borrowed some language and ideas from a philosopher of science that gets talked about a lot. We talk about him a lot at Gutenberg. His name was Kuhn. And he came along and really threw a big bomb into the world of philosophy of science and thinking about how science is done. Because scientists like to think of themselves as very objective. You know, look, we just get out there, we look at the evidence, we propose hypotheses, and we falsify them, and this is very objective. This is the way you come to know what's true. And Kuhn came along and said, you know, if you look at the history of science, that's not really the way it worked at all. What happens is a community of scientists develop what he called a paradigm Think of it like a worldview. It's a picture of reality. I have this picture in my head, and this community of scientists have this picture in their head of how it is that the world works. And that paradigm tells them which questions are interesting. For some questions are not even interesting to them because their model of the world tells them that it's not interesting. And you can do an experiment and come along and see something interesting, and they'll say, yeah, but I don't buy it. And the reason they don't buy it is because it doesn't fit the paradigm that they have. Charlie, in his book on science, Saving Science, which I recommend if you're interested in this kind of stuff at all, Charlie talks about examples of that sort of thing where, you know, after Einstein proposed his theory of relativity, that there were experiments that were done that demonstrated that it wasn't true. And basically, they were put aside. There must be something wrong with those experiments. We'll figure out later what's wrong with those experiments. But he's got it here. We know he's got it, and so we're just gonna put those aside and figure out what's wrong with them later. So much for the objectivity of science. I mean, the idea is basically I look at the world in according to this model, and if something fits in the model, then I accept it, and if it doesn't fit in the model, then I say, well, that's not going to work, and then Kuhn proposed that what happens, though, is eventually there are enough tensions that build up in the model. If you do that often enough, there are enough experiments that don't work, enough questions that you can't answer, that this tension becomes palpable, and someone will come along and propose a new paradigm. And what makes the new paradigm interesting is it answers those questions that we couldn't answer in the old one. And so now we have a new picture of the way things work. And now, once again, that informs what we think is true and what isn't true. Now, I should say that Kuhn is sometimes understood to be arguing that there really is no truth ultimately. We just move from one paradigm to another and there's no difference between them. No paradigm is any better than any other. I don't know whether that's fair to him. But I am not embracing that picture at all. I mean, we have been designed by God to be able to understand the world that we live in. What I'm proposing, though, is that each of us, in our way, what happens to us is we come into a community, we have parents and a community around us that hand us a picture of the world. Part of it is related to the way we're designed. We have a mind. We have mental capabilities. We have emotions. We have a will. And all of that works in us in such a way that we take the model that is handed to us and we work on it and we kind of adapt it and we ultimately come to have our own picture of the way things work. I'm going to use this word a lot, our own paradigm or our own worldview. And what happens then with that model is that when something comes along and the question arises, am I going to accept this as true or not? That most often what we do is that fits easily into my paradigm, into my picture of the world, I accept as true. And that which is in tension with it that doesn't fit, I don't accept as true. It seems to me that that's closer to the sort of thing that we do as we're going through life. Because if you've ever stopped to think about it, you know, to articulate to yourself what's going on, when we go along and we're deciding what's true and what we believe and so on, sometimes we may actually sit down and think, you know, step by step, okay, well, I think this is true and that would imply this and so on. But most of the time we don't. We come to that decision about what's true or not true very quickly. It's just, you know, if you tell me a story about somebody, this new age guru who goes out into the New Mexico desert and floats around in the air because of the power of his mind, I just don't buy it. I mean, it's not like in 5 minutes I don't buy it because I stop and think about it and say, well, that would involve, you know, gravity and, let's see, Newton and, you know, and all that. I don't buy it the instant I hear it. I don't buy it. And the reason I don't buy it is it doesn't fit reality the way I understand reality to be. Now you understand, what if reality is that way? What if there are all kinds of new age gurus floating around the New Mexico desert? Well, I'm not going to discover this fact very easily because I have a model that excludes it. It's not true. It's just not what's going on. So what's important, what I want to get across in this model is it is this picture that we have that is our primary tool, it seems to me at this point, for evaluating what it is that's true and what's not true. Now, I think this is an appropriate way to think about things, and it's an appropriate thing that we do, because we are designed by God to believe that the world is coherent, that it makes sense. And so if I have a picture of the world that says it's like this, then I expect the things that I encounter to fit that picture, because the world is a coherent place. It's not true that you are sitting in your chair and you're floating halfway to the ceiling at the same time. I mean, one or the other of those things is true. I just know that that's the case. There's all kinds of things I know about the world that I say, well, this thing is ultimately going to have to make sense and fit together. So most of the things that we believe, or many of the things that we believe, it seems to me, we have those beliefs not because we have articulated a set of proofs for their existence, but we believe them because we have a picture of reality and our beliefs fit that picture. Now, there's a lot that we could say about that, but I'm just going to let that go for now. I do want to defend what I'm saying against the charge that I don't believe in absolute truth, that there is a truth or things are either true or false. I think that the way our minds are designed to work is we believe those things that work in our paradigm. But that doesn't mean that the truth value of them is determined by whether they work, because the fact is there are things that are true and things that are false. I may have a paradigm that's not accurate. In fact, I do, and so do you. Each of us have a worldview that is defective in some ways, and that means that we're going to accept some things easily that we shouldn't be accepting because they don't fit the way things are. But this is the way God designed us to work. I kind of picture us as being, let me hold off on that, because I have one other thing that I want to talk about here. So how do you change your mind in this scenario? I get this paradigm, and if something comes into it that doesn't fit, I reject it. So how do I end up changing my mind? Well, I like this idea that I'm borrowing from Kuhn about the way what he calls a paradigm shift happens. How do I shift from one model to another? Well, I shift because the paradigm I'm in has problems. There is a tension in it. I can't make everything work. And ultimately, I get to the point where it's too bad. I just can't live with the tension in the paradigm anymore. Ultimately, we feel right in switching to a new paradigm if the new paradigm solves more problems than the old one did. And I think this is the sort of thing that we do. We are conservative by nature, and I think it's appropriate. If something comes along that challenges my paradigm, I don't immediately shift paradigms. I recognize that, no, there could be explanations for that. A magician can, in front of my eyes, defy the law of gravity. Or someone can come along, you know, a logician can come along and recite Zeno's paradox to me. Did you know that it's impossible for you to move? Of course it's impossible for you to move, because I can take my hand and move it from here to here. But before my hand can get over here, it has to get halfway there. Before it can get halfway there, it has to get halfway to halfway there. And before it can get halfway to halfway there, it has to get halfway to halfway to halfway there. And as many times as you break it down, there's always another. I can always divide in half how far it is that I have to go from where I am to where I have to move. And an infinite number of movements cannot happen in a finite amount of time. So, therefore, motion is impossible. Okay? I see you moving. You're still moving out there. I've just demonstrated that it's impossible. What are you, irrational? Don't you believe in logic? Okay, well, I mean, the fact is, even if you don't have a good answer to Zeno's paradox, if I were to say, okay, prove what's wrong with that, and it's, I don't know. Sounds reasonable, actually. I can't figure out what's wrong with it. That doesn't change anything. You're still not going to buy it. because it doesn't fit with the way you look at the world. Some enemy can come along and try to construct a proof for me that my wife is unfaithful or something like that. But it's a truism of human experience that I would be a creep if I was to take somebody comes along and says, oh, look, see, I saw your wife having coffee with this guy, and I immediately jump to the conclusion that she's being unfaithful or something. Because I have a picture of the world that has been shaped by decades of experience with my wife that I don't just throw away just because something comes along and says, well, you know, it might be different. So there's a conservatism to the way we operate. We keep our paradigm even though there are things in it that don't necessarily work. But there comes that point where enough comes that I have to deal with that I can't make work in the paradigm that I've got that will make me change my mind. So I think that this model of how we know things is helpful to us as we think about apologetics and as we think about the process of how we come to know God and how we convert, how we change our minds. In Romans 1, which let me read to you this little section from Romans 1 here, very famous section. If you're going to debate about apologetics, you have to deal with Romans 1. Everybody has to deal with this passage. We're in Romans 1, starting with verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. And I might point out at the very end of Romans 1, there is a statement that also people often refer to in the very last verse, 32. And although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. So, there is a ton of debate about what it is that Romans 1 is telling us about our relationship to the knowledge of God. It's saying that we as human beings, we don't need the scriptures to come along and tell us about God. We know about God already. But what sort of a knowing about God is this that it's talking about? Is this an innate knowledge that I'm just born knowing that God exists? It's just a part of my equipment. It's not something I reason my way to. It's just I know it, but then I put it aside. Or is it something that arises out of my reasoning ability? God gives me a mind that can know the truth, and it is designed such that when I see creation, I come to the conclusion that there is a God. So it's not that I start out knowing it, but that it becomes apparent to me, or it should become apparent to me. The way I am designed to know the world in such a way that I recognize that there's a God there. Well, it seems to me that the Romans 1 passage, if Paul does believe in an innate knowledge of God, that I just am born, I know that God is there. It doesn't need reasons or anything, it's just there. That's not what he's arguing for in Romans 1. If he believes it, that's not what he's telling us. He seems very clearly to be making this distinction between what is sometimes referred to as general and special revelation. Special revelation being the Bible, God revealing himself in the text of Scripture. But general revelation being just God's revelation of himself in creation. That what we see in creation tells us something about God. It seems to me that there are a couple things Paul is getting at here that are significant. One of the things is that our knowledge of God, mankind's knowledge of God, is not just a bare knowledge that there is a God, but actually God has revealed something of his nature. His eternal power and divinity are clear enough that pagans are morally culpable for worshiping inferior idols with the forms of men and animals. The pagans are not commended. Wow, you guys are theists. That's great. You know, you really made some progress here. They are condemned because they are worshiping the wrong gods. So creation, according to Paul, has enough specific to say that it tells us not just that there is a God, but it tells us that there is the transcendent God, the creator of all, that he is powerful, that he has made everything that is, and that he is moral, because we see at the end that Paul is asserting that we understand that it is wrong to do certain things, and that the one who made us is not pleased with when we go against what we ought to do. So that seems to be the picture that Paul has. But the second thing that seems important to me here in what he's saying is that we know about God because God has taken his invisible attributes, those things which we couldn't know because he is invisible and unseen and we can't know him by going and looking at him, he has made himself known through what he has created. You look at creation and you learn something about the creator, he's saying. So he's not arguing that we have an innate knowledge of God. He's arguing that God has testified to himself in creation. So the idea seems to be that our minds are made such that we can recognize reality. We can see what the world is like. We can learn about it. And one of the things we can learn is about the nature and existence of the one who created all of this. That there is plenty there to tell us about the one who made us. Now, if that's the case, what is it about creation that tells us this? Well, Paul doesn't say. He doesn't talk about how it is that the creation communicates these things to us. He just says that creation communicates these things to us. So as we're thinking about the process of apologetics, talking to someone else about God and about Christianity in particular, this is one of the things we have to keep in mind, is that the Bible is saying that humanity starts with a knowledge of God that it has put aside, and we'll talk about the put aside here in a second, but that there is the creation testifies to God. How it does that, I'm in no position to be dogmatic, but here's what makes sense to me right now. I'm going to throw one more big word at you. In the discussion about apologetics, there is a kind of argumentation that is often referred to as borrowed the language from Kant, and it talks about the transcendental argument for the existence of God. And the idea here is that if there is no God who made me what I am, then the very process of thinking about myself and the world has no basis. How is it that I can know that there's any relationship between my senses and the reality of the world out there? Well, in the biblical worldview, there is a creator who made me such that I am made in his image, and I can know the world because he made me to know the world. And then we can explore any number of other questions. What is the basis for my personhood? Why am I a person in an impersonal world? How is it that I know that there are things that are right and things that are wrong? Why is it that I, in my mental equipment, I look at the world and I see order and purpose? What is it that leads to that? What accounts for my emotional makeup? Why do I long for something that I don't have in this world? Why do I long for relationships? And why do I long for what the Bible would call glory? What is it what is it about all of those things? My perspective right now would be that the paradigm, the worldview in which there is the biblical God who created me and the world explains everything about who I am as a human being. Everything that I know about myself and the world fits. Whereas the paradigm in which there is no God who created me, nothing about myself fits. I have no basis to trust my reason. I have no basis to understand my moral sense, my personhood, my longings. I mean, everything about me. I see design, but there is no design. I find myself thinking that I am understanding the world that I experience, but there's no reason to think that I do. I have longings, but there is nothing to fulfill those longings. So in one model, everything fits, and in the other model, nothing fits. It seems to me, at least this is how I would think about it right now, is that if we were not morally flawed, we would work our way very quickly to the picture of the world where there is a God, because in that model, there is no tension with my experience. Everything works. Everything fits. Whereas over here, I am constantly fighting. You notice that human beings talk as if they understand reality. They talk as if reason works. They talk as if there are moral absolutes. They talk as if there were purpose. They always talk as if there were purpose, because we can't not talk that way, because that's the way we're made. And yet the paradigm that we live in without God is in constant tension with most everything that we try to do as human beings. That's the way I look at it right now. So it seems to me not that I have an innate knowledge there is a God, but I have rational, moral, volitional makeup that I have been given by God that would move me very quickly to see that there has to be a God very much like the God of the Bible in order for someone like me to make sense. That's how I would look at it right now. But we have this problem. We have the moral problem that we do not want to accept the truth that there is a God, because it puts us under obligation to him. And that's the sort of thing that Paul is talking about in Romans 1, suppressing the knowledge of God. We have gone another way. So volition, our will, is a very crucial part of the way we know the world. We can very easily arrive at a paradigm that is not the best paradigm to explain the world that I live in. It has all sorts of tensions and contradictions in it, but I like it because I don't like the world that I end up with if I accept the one that makes more sense. So, new model of things that more fully explains everything that we're trying to understand, and yet we resist it because we don't like what it says about us as creatures and what it says about God as our creator. So there are a couple of things that arise from this, and I'll just try to make a few concluding comments and bring it to an end here. But there are a couple of things that I like about this model. First of all, it makes sense to me of the way that I process the world, and I think it is an appropriate answer to this issue that the presuppositionalists are raising. What they're saying is, look, if you presuppose God, then you arrive at Christian view of the world, and if you presuppose no God, then you don't, and so what can you do about it? It seems to me that they haven't really adequately described the way we understand things. That what in fact happens is, I have a worldview right now, but as problems develop with it, I take an alternate proposal for the way the world works, and I put it in my mind alongside. Basically, what I do is I take it for a test drive before I buy it. I try it out, and I say, you know, right now I'm still standing over here in this paradigm where there is no God, but I understand that if I were to accept the picture of Jesus in the Bible and so on, that I would be working on a different set of presuppositions and have a different model of the world. What would that be like? And I'm putting those things next to each other in my mind. What would happen if I didn't have the moral problem that I didn't want God to be messing with my life is ultimately, in putting those two together, I would recognize the vast superiority of the worldview that has God in it, and I would go there. So it seems to me then that if we're to think about what is appropriate in apologetics, if I'm thinking about what is my role, I'm not playing the role of the Holy Spirit, but the most helpful and loving thing that I can do with somebody else is to try to lay out for them the two models of reality and to do a couple of things. I want to highlight this one is not working. This one has some problems with it. Not just intellectual problems, although it does have intellectual problems, but it has emotional problems. It's hard to live in that paradigm. And it has all sorts of tensions that you're not really dealing with. And then on the other side, to propose that the picture of the world that the Bible is presenting is more worthy of your belief because it doesn't have the tensions that the worldview that you're working with does. And then finally, there is that aspect of we have to be prepared to deal with attacks. I mean, you know, no, that paradigm, the God paradigm, doesn't make sense because of Darwin or because of whatever. We would want to be able to address why is that not a problem, you know. So the process of apologetics, it seems to me, the connection between reason and faith is a fairly strong one, that the presuppositionalists who are saying, I just proclaim the Bible and I don't give reasons because that's futile, if that's really what they're arguing for, and some of them don't, I think, but if that's what they're arguing, I think they've misunderstood the way we come to think about things. The fact is that, yes, they have their presuppositions here, but that's always true. How do I explain that anybody ever changes their mind about anything? They change their mind because you have an alternate put alongside, and you look at the two of them and ultimately decide which one is going to work better. Now, is there a moral problem that's keeping them from moving from one to the other? Yes. Is there anything I can do about that moral problem? No. Is that totally in the hands of God? Yes. But the fact is I'm still, I think, doing them a favor to point out that there are these tensions in theirs, that this model works not just intellectually, but it satisfies my humanity. It deals with my sense of guilt. I mean, it deals with the whole package of who I am as an individual. What sort of evidence am I going to give for the tensions in this model and the superiority of this model? I do kind of have a predilection for what I was talking about earlier, this transcendental model. There are a lot of things that you could argue. There are all sorts of things that you could talk about. Evidences for the truth of the Bible and all that kind of stuff. That's all fine and good. But ultimately, I think all of that comes back to, in the end, the question of, is your model of reality working or not? And I mean that in the deepest sense. That ultimately, it comes back to that question. In the paradigm that I'm sitting, I have an explanation for how I can know the world and why I have a sense of what is right and wrong and where my personhood comes from and why I as a person am different from the rest of creation and why it is that I have a moral problem and why it is that I have longings for something that this world cannot fulfill and all of that. That in the end, I think the kind of argument that makes the most sense is to say, look, you're hanging on to a model that's really not working so well. What's so attractive about this? Why are you hanging on to it so tightly? Because the fact is that this one deals with your humanity in a way that no other paradigm that you're going to find will do. That's how I would look at the process. Now, actually, a lot of what my paper is about doesn't talk about these things. Some of this is in my paper, but I have to go on and kind of critique those five perspectives and you know, how does it compare with the model that I'm proposing here. And Fortunately for you, there's just not time to talk about that stuff this morning. So you are spared having to go through all of that stuff. But I wanted to just try to give you kind of an overall picture of how this works. One of the things I like about this picture is I think many of us out there in the world and in our own lives, we have this sense, you know, I'm a Christian, but I couldn't give you a set of syllogisms that prove why Christianity is true. You know, I couldn't give you the logical steps that say, well, you start here, and then you go to here, and then you go to here, and I can prove to you through premises that are unshakable and logic that is incontrovertible that Christianity is true. And we feel shaky about that. Like, well, maybe I have no rationale for believing. Maybe there's something wrong with where I am. Now, it is always appropriate for us to go and try to understand the rational basis for our beliefs. And I think it's always appropriate for us to keep trying to learn that. But there is an aspect to belief, I think, it comes about not through being able to step by step show the logic of it, but it is this picture of I have stepped into this model because it makes more sense of my life. It just things work better over here. And now I have to stop and ask myself the question, if somebody gives a rational challenge, yeah, but could that there be true? Then I have to need to think about that and talk to people and say, yeah, I should answer that question. Can that be true? But it is our nature as human beings not to come up with step-by-step logical steps to come up with a worldview, but it is a process of embracing that which makes the most sense, which works with everything that I know about myself and the world. My logic, my intuitions, my emotions, my desires, my choices. Ultimately, I want to be in that model of the world that makes sense of all of that, that everything about me works and everything about the world works in that model. So that way, yes, we ought to be prepared to talk about the rational basis for our faith. We ought to listen to the challenge of unbelievers and say, okay, yeah, that's a good question. Let's deal with that. But ultimately, we are not irrational or unjustified in being believers in having moved to the paradigm that fits, even though we can't explain yet all the ways that it does fit. Okay, so I have no idea what this was. I don't know if this was helpful to anybody or at all, but that's what I did. So now you have an opportunity to ask any questions or make any comments. I know we're running a little late, but I've got to give you a chance to at least chew me out or something. So
I thought that was great, and I hope you get a chance to have more of a dialogue with your teacher, because I think he's going to think it's great too once he understands.
I don't know. He's been doing this for a long time. He's prepared for every argument against presuppositionalism that anybody's ever.
Well, you've been
mounted.
Doing this for a long time too, Ron.
Yeah.
The gray in their beard didn't get there like overnight.
True.
Okay. I would like you to, if you could, clarify what you mean by work. Because, like, at one time the study center had a, what are those things we do, an Oktoberfest or something like that, entitled, Does Christianity Work?
Right.
And we were using the word work in a different sense that you're using.
Yes.
In one sense, Christianity doesn't work. In another sense, it does. You're talking about this paradigm works as opposed to this doesn't. Somebody who maybe was hearing this for the first time might mistakenly understand you to be saying, my life goes better when I believe in Christianity. I'm happier. I have less difficulties, that kind of thing. So would you clarify?
Right. When we were talking about that question of does Christianity work, we were addressing a model that says, yes, become a Christian and all your problems will be solved. You will feel better. You won't suffer anymore, or, you know, that sort of thing. That's not what I mean. I'm talking about working in the sense of everything fitting. There is the least intellectual, emotional, volitional tension in my model of the world. I may be suffering more as a Christian, but I have embraced that picture of the world that commends itself as being true because it fits everything about what I am and what I experience. That's what I mean by working. I mean, you can think about it in philosophical terms. I mean, one of the things that Christianity has to say to the world is, you know, going all the way back to someone like Descartes, there is this thing that has come about where people have been looking for this certainty and this question, how can I ultimately figure out what my relationship is to the world? Do I know anything true? And there's a great skepticism that has grown through the philosophical channels over the years. And one of the things that the biblical worldview has to say is, you know, when you guys threw out God, you threw out the way of explaining how it is that you can know the world. And the fact is that we don't have to have that. We're not reduced to that skepticism because, yeah, it's theoretically possible that there's no connection between how I process the sensory data and what's really happening in the world. But I was designed by a God who knows the world that he made. So my equipment works for coming to understand the world. Sorry about yours. I mean, it's so too bad yours doesn't work, but mine does. So,
and when you talk about the emotional pressure, you're not saying I believe it because it makes me feel better to believe it.
No, but I think our emotions are a part of our rationality. This is a big topic, and I can't go into all of it. But I mean, there are part of what makes a worldview satisfying to us is that we can rest in it. This is language that I do like from Frame. He talks about cognitive rest. That there's this place where I come to believe something is true in such a partly because, I mean, if it was only a question of it makes me feel good, then that would be irrational. But ultimately, the truth is going to feel right. It's not necessarily always going to be comfortable, but, the fact that I am aware of my moral failings, the fact that I am aware that I am not what I would like to be as a human being, produces feelings in me that have no resolution in the non-Christian worldview. But they do have a resolution in the Christian worldview, and that's not insignificant. That's not it's not a justification by itself, but it's a part of what I'm looking at and saying this model fits everything. It fits everything that I am, and the way I know things, the way I feel things, and everything. That's what I mean.
Ron, you're talking about an approach. Approach is what you're looking for.
That's what the debate is about, yes. But back behind the issue of approach is really the debate is about the relationship between faith and reason. I mean, the fact of my believing in God and believing in Christ, what relationship does that have to evidence and reasoning processes and that sort of thing? And that's where people in the area of apologetics have differences of perspective. It's about approach, but the reason that they take different approaches is that they have a different philosophical idea of how reason and faith relate to each other.
Christians are theologians, not philosophers.
Well, I'd have to know what you mean by that.
Our starting point is God, not with man. You see, once you get into shifting paradigms, you're ultimately just committing the faux pas of circular reasoning.
Right, and that's... So, if I start with God?
Start with God.
Okay.
Right.
And I end up believing in God, therefore? How is that not circular reasoning?
Well, the thing is, we know that you proved your own point that in starting with Romans, Paul's already laid it out for us that the reason why man rejects God is because he likes immorality. So therefore, like kids, this is what Paul is saying, basically. Like kids, we have to proclaim him, as foolish as it is, because in preaching, it is like the hammer hitting the nail on the wood. The wood's going to stick if you just try to reason it in. It's kind of like a bunch of psychiatrists getting around a light bulb. How many to take the screw on the light bulb? Well, first of all, the light bulb has to want to change, and that's where the thinking is.
Yeah, George, this is a really complicated question.
It's not that complex.
Well, okay, let me put it this way. For me to explain why it is I don't agree with the perspective that you just talked about would take me a while. And part of it would be we have to define what we mean when we talk about starting with God. The sort of thing I'm talking about is if you look at Romans 1, Paul is not starting with God. What he's describing is creation testifies to God. So there is a process involved where I, as the creature that I am, I look at creation, I come to understand that there was a creator behind it, and I arrive at the understanding that there is a God. Now, but I had to start with the equipment that God gave me. I mean, he gave me a way of knowing the world, and what I start with is the way that I have to know the world, and then I come to understand that there's a God. That's what I mean. That's the sort of thing that I'm describing with the paradigms and the way this works. That's the way God made us to know. That's not starting with man in the sense that I am putting myself above God. It's just starting with what God has given me. I mean, I'm not God. I don't have an infallible knowledge of reality. What I have is a mind that is capable of looking at creation and coming to know God. So in that sense, I think that's, if we're talking about the process involved, yeah, God comes very soon in the process, and it is I've rejected that knowledge because I don't want it. I mean, that's absolutely true. But it is ultimately the starting place for us as human beings has to be the minds that God gave us. I mean, I don't have a way of jumping to the truth apart from the mind that God gave me to know the truth. And that's all I mean.
Not to argue with you by any means, merely to point out again, though, I think we need to be reminded, because when we come to church, our minds need to be renewed. And in particular with the gospel, the gospel's our interpretive principle, and apologetics is basically for the believer, because we defend our own selves against our own sin principle, which wars against us in our minds, in our thinking every day. We are trying to be obedient to bring every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. This is our this is one of our objectives as Christians.
Okay. Well, thanks. I certainly agree half with what you're saying. I think apologetics is as important for believers as it is for unbelievers. I don't think I could go as far as to say that it is for believers, but yeah.
See, I've argued in this arena with a lot of guys, and aside from being somewhat scholarly and all of this kind of thing, getting down to the street level is basically where most people are at, because they do have very tough questions to ask, and oftentimes it ultimately boils down to dealing with the whole issue of justice more than anything. And I would suggest there is the starting point for any kind of talking to anybody. Justice. Everyone wants to know whether or not it's fair or whether it's not fair. So if you have the correct presuppositional frame of reference, you can shift with the paradigm of the situation and channel through your thinking to more or less stimulate a person's thinking away from oftentimes their own immorality that they're locked in with.
Yeah, well, thanks. It's really late, but did anybody else have a question they want to? No, go ahead. We'll take one more.
The Alvin Plantagen, was he one of the five perspectives?
Yeah. In the book, it's referred to as Reformed epistemology. Okay. I've decided not to throw that phrase at you, but it comes from Plantagen. He, and there are other people who are influenced by his work, so there's kind of a little group that argues for this perspective, this idea that belief in God is a properly basic belief. That is, that it's just something I have and does not need rational defense. I need to defend it against, if someone gives an objection, then I need to give a rational defense why that objection doesn't hold water. But to have the belief in God, they would say, that starts as being rational apart from any defense. No defense is needed.
In chapter 2 of Romans, it says, for when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these not having the law are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending themselves. It goes on, but it seems to me that combined with general revelation, the verses that you read, are in keeping with what Alvin Plantagen was saying. Would you agree with that? And how is that different from what you're saying?
That's tricky. That is tricky for two reasons. I think I know what you're saying when you read that passage, but I actually have changed my mind on what that passage in Romans means. I used to think what you're saying, and now I don't think that anymore. So that makes it tricky. And then the other thing is, it's hard. Plantinga is a philosopher. I mean, this is very esoteric kind of stuff that he's doing. The key to the idea, though, is not... See, I think everyone would agree, God has given me a mind that can know things, which includes an understanding of morality. I mean, I understand the concepts of fairness and justice. And I mean, there's something in me, innate, that God has given me. Plantinga would be saying more than that, though. He's saying the very knowledge that God exists is... I just start with that. I just have it. It's like I look at the world and I say, oh, there's a God. It's not a rational process. It doesn't need any rational defense because I'm designed that way, just like I look at the chair and say, oh, there's a chair. I look at the chair and I say, oh, there's a chair, and there's a God. That's how Plantinga would... So his thought is not just that I have been made with a mind that works and a moral sense, but that I actually have a specific knowledge of God that arises out of my mind without any defense for it, which is different. I mean, what I'm saying is Romans 1 does not necessarily say that. It says that creation testifies and that I have a moral sense of what's right and wrong. But it doesn't say specifically that I start out knowing that there's a God. So there's a little difference there. It's kind of subtle. Okay, sorry to go so late. Thanks.